Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies podcast. I'm your host, Samantha Lam, and today we are interviewing Nicholas Breifogel about the book he's the editor of, Eurasian Environments, Nature and Ecology in Imperial Russia and Soviet History. So thank you for being with us today. Would you like to tell us just a couple of words about yourself?
Absolutely, Samantha. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast. So my name is Nick Breifogel. I'm a professor at the Ohio State University in the history department, and I'm a specialist in both Russian history, Russian Soviet history, and also global environmental history. And for the last kind of 10 plus years, I've been one of the editors of the online magazine Origins, Current Events and Historical Perspective.
So why is a book on Russian and Soviet environmental history important?
I think it's important for two reasons. One being the importance to the contemporary world in the sense that we face tremendous kind of environmental problems and environmental issues from climate to water to pollution to health issues. I mean, the list goes on. And Russia, in particular, the Russian Empire, having been as much as 1/6 of the world's surface, they have a tremendous amount to teach us as we confront contemporary environmental issues. At the same time, I thought that the book was really important to put together to kind of move scholarship forward. And what I mean by that is that I think that there's a tremendous amount that people who study Russian history can learn from the study of the environment. And there's also a tremendous amount that historians of the environment around the world can learn from the study of Russia. Environmental history is a relatively new field of study for scholars, really in the last kind of 30, 40 years, it's really taken off. And there's a tremendous amount that I think we can learn and helps us to rethink fundamental questions about Russian history and about world history by looking at the environmental questions. And this is the kind of book that had to be written in some ways as an edited collection, as one with a wide variety of different contributing authors, because the range of locations and time periods and topics is so great that we needed the expertise of all the different people who come together to make this book possible.
So this idea of sort of expanding the way historians look at the world, I think, is really interesting. I do a lot of work on collectivization and agricultural history, and that mm-hmm. seems to be something that I notice is missing from a lot of contemporary works on collectivization, is people don't look at things such as rainfall, snowfall, diseases cattle get, diseases that affect crops, and how this, plus, of course, really bad Soviet policies led to famine. But they tend to focus more on the political aspects and not for the fact that we can get like snow in June in Kirov. You know, the government can't really control that. So are there other ways that you see environmental history touching on some of these more important or more commonly studied topics in Soviet history?
Mm-hmm. I mean, in many respects, taking an environmental historical approach allows us to rethink, just about everything we think we know about Russian history or indeed about human history in general. I mean, environmental history starts from the assumption that at its foundation, human history is only rarely, if at all, just simply the history of humanity. The humans exist in an extraordinarily intricate web of relationships with with both the organic and inorganic world, and that these have tremendous impacts on the outcomes of human life, that we don't make the world in the way that we want it to be much of the time. And environmental history is, it changes how we think about a lot of things. On the one hand, you know, there's a whole variety of different types of sources or methodologies that we can use in environmental history that give us insight into a particular topic. So in addition to, you know, the standard historian's toolkit of both kind of published and unpublished documents and books and oral history and this sort of thing, now you can add, you know, what we can learn from ice cores or pollen samples or tree rings or varves or genomic analysis, or I mean, and the list kind of goes on, so that these kinds of new types of sources can really help us see the world in a very different sort of way. What's also marvelous about environmental history is that, you know, ultimately, everybody who lives on the planet exists in an environment. And so it's an approach to history that is immediately comparative across time and across place. And so one of the things that it does in particular, and that this book really highlights, is the way in which the Soviet experience looks very similar to many other parts of the world. There was a tendency, you know, over the previous decades, and particularly during the Cold War, to see the Soviet Union as somehow fundamentally different, that they had gone off in a completely different path. And yet, when one looks at Soviet history through an environmental lens, one realizes that many of the policies and practices that the Soviet industrialists or agriculturalists or policymakers up to, that these are very, very similar to what we see in other parts of the world. And it's a good reminder of the way in which these kinds of differences in political system that we as humans often think are tremendously important, in this case, at least in the modern era, often aren't. And that there's a shared way of thinking and approaching economic development and these sorts of things, and resource use in the modern era, that is shared across almost any political system one looks at. The other thing that the environmental history really points to is kind of continuities across time. Environmental history really asks us to kind of rethink the time frames in which we look at the human experience. And obviously, as humans, we think about time as it relates to our everyday lives, the minutes, the hours, the weeks, the years of our lives. But these are not always the best ways of kind of seeing processes of historical causation or historical change take place. And so, you know, the authors in this book make very clear on a number of occasions the degree to which many of the things many of the policies or environmental activities that we see in the Soviet period, that these are not peculiarly Soviet, but that they have very clear roots and origins in the Tsarist period and even before that, and that there may be, I don't know, different emphases or accelerations or this sort of thing, but that there's a fundamental process to modern kind of Russian history, from Tsarist through Soviet into post-Soviet, that shares a lot of characteristics. And so seeing the history not based upon the usual political divisions that we think are so important, but rather divisions based upon changes in how humans interact with the natural world, that these unveil a different way of thinking about Russian and Soviet history.
So let's talk about this a little bit more. Mm-hmm. You actually begin the book with a tale of two dams built 150 years apart. So they very nicely bridge these sort of artificial historical time periods we've created. Would you like to tell us briefly about these stories and why they're important?
Sure. Well, I mean, I start the book with these two. They're two great, just great moments from two wonderful pieces of Russian literature. One, a book called The Family Chronicle by Sergei Aksakov from the early part of the 19th century, and then a second called Farewell to Matyora by Valentin Rasputin from the kind of post-war period. And both deal with the building of dams, but very different types of dams. The story that Aksakov tells is one of it's a very small river. It's his family, with the help of all their serfs and many others, block up the river by, you know, sticking in big pylons and then throwing in whatever debris they can to catch and eventually to kind of block the water. And then they build a mill for grinding grain on the side. And it's a way for them then to make the food that they need in their particular area. The dam in the, from the second story is a very different one. Rasputin tells the story of the building of the Bratsk Dam, which was at the time it was built, the largest hydroelectric dam in the world, a massive undertaking that flooded a vast amount of territory behind it when they closed up the dam. And Rasputin tells the story of a kind of village and an island in the middle of a river that is about to go underwater once they start to fill up the reservoir behind the Bratsk Dam. And I start with these stories because they reflect both the continuities and changes of how Russians have related to water and to damming. The continuities that are very clear in both of these stories is the importance of control over nature, and the aspiration of humans to be able to somehow control nature and put nature to their uses and devices and for their own ends. There's a tremendous continuity from what we might see as a kind of colonial or imperial perspective, in the sense that both of these dams are ones that are built in territory that had been conquered by Russia, that had previously not been settled by Russian peoples, one the kind of Bashkir lands, the other territory that had been inhabited by Buryats, and the way in which both of these stories focus on the importance of controlling nature for Russians as part of the process of imperial control in those regions. A third kind of continuity is the kind of focus of the local and the global. In both of these stories, the authors really give you an incredible sense of the actual place in which these take place. You can hear the water rushing by, you can feel the temperature, you can see the kind of the mud and the debris in the water, and yet at the same time, in both of these cases, these are very, very local events at the same time that they're taking place in a much larger global context. Imperial expansion in the 19th century, hydroelectric development in the 20th century, these are world processes that take place in the hundreds and thousands of other locations around the world. So these are both shared and very similar stories across the planet, at the same time that they are very, very local and defined by the specificities of the place and the river that they're in. So there are these kinds of continuities that you see in these stories, but there's also really important changes. And in particular, just the ways in which these two authors think about the dammings of the river and the possibilities of control of nature. Aksakov in the 19th century is a story of unambiguous kind of triumphalism. Ultimately, it's a story of his grandfather conquering the river and, as a result, putting his stamp on the control of this particular place. Rasputin is a little bit more ambivalent and ambiguous, that it is a kind of mixed story. On the one hand, they're building what is the largest hydroelectric dam anywhere at that point. But on the other hand, there is this sort of uncertainty that, in fact, humans can aspire to try to control this natural world. Rasputin is filled with all these sort of great lines, with these characters talking with each other. One in particular strikes me, where there's one young son who says to his grandmother, "Man is king of nature." And then the grandmother replies, "Yes, yes, king. Just rain a bit and you'll be sorry." This idea that somehow trying to control nature is going to make you sorry, that it's not going to, ruling over nature is not going to turn out the way that you want it to. So that there's a big change in terms of how the humans in these two different stories are thinking about just the possibilities of human control of nature. And so it reflects this fundamental transformation of how humans are thinking about these questions. And of course, the dams are totally different things. The first dam that Aksakov describes being built is a tiny, quaint, lovely little thing in comparison to the monster of concrete that is the Bratsk Dam. And so that there's a huge, even if humans are building dams in both centuries, the type of dam is a completely different thing. And that change in kind of size and is such that it really becomes almost a different type of entity. So we see these kinds of continuities and changes in these two stories that help to kind of set the stage for a lot of the work for a lot of the research that's in the book.
The Soviet Union tends to be particularly well known for its dam irrigation and hydropower, projects. I've interviewed several authors about them, and they tend to sort of decide that they work really well as propaganda, that they're really good at projecting the mastery of nature as a propaganda tool, but as an actual functioning object, they tend to be sort of an ecological disaster that ends up costing many workers their lives, and often being too shallow for the draft of large shifts or otherwise ineffective. The same is true with irrigation projects, particularly in Central Asia. They tend to be viewed as unmitigated disasters. In this book, you have two different authors who write about these Soviet projects. What sort of conclusions do they draw?
No, it's a great question. One of the things that the book, I think basically all of the authors in the book try to do is to push away from that kind of, almost what's become a sort of stereotype that you've just described, that ultimately everything that the Soviet Union touched when it came to the environment, you know, turned to, horrific outcomes, death, pestilence, pollution, all of these sorts of things. And the authors of the book really try to push back against that to a degree, and particularly that there's the idea of ecocide that the Soviet Union in some ways unleashed upon itself. I mean, it carried out a kind of self-suicide through ecological kinds of means, through destroying public health, through pollution, through environmental degradation, and these sorts of things. And the authors, in many respects, they're not trying to say that that these things didn't happen, that there weren't obviously huge environmental problems, but of course there are huge environmental problems across the planet in the 20th century, but rather to really explore, on the one hand, that things weren't as comparatively bad as often we like to think, and on the other hand, they stop and try to explore, well, what are the reasons for when we do have extreme pollution or environmental degradation or these sorts of things? What are the reasons for it? And in particular, many of these articles underline the ways in which, in fact, the human relationship with the natural world was a big part of what defined the actual kind of pollution outcomes. And so rather than just being a kind of political decisions of unthoughtful elites, although that was a big part of it, there's a whole variety of other reasons to explore here. And the two articles that you were mentioning in particular, both deal with kind of water projects and water manipulation in Central Asia in the 20th century. One by Christian Teichmann that explores the kind of irrigation networks in Central Asia and efforts on the part of the Soviet state to try to administer them, because one of the points that he makes that is really important is the way in which, you know, ultimately the management of water, the distribution of water, who gets access to water, when and where, these are tremendously important political questions, and in fact, existential questions for the people in those areas. So that a big part of how Soviet power was experienced, how it was manifested in the Central Asian regions, really focused in on the whole question of administering the irrigation system. So, you know, cleaning the canals and looking after them, and then deciding who gets which water, when, and how. And one of the things that Damon Teichmann really underscores is the way in which you have an interesting combination of factors that come together to determine the outcomes there. I mean, at the end of the day, he really sees the Soviet state in this area being what he called both arbitrary and kind of violent in terms of how it approached the local population. But he doesn't see this solely as a result of the nature of the Soviet system, of the ideology of the Soviet system, but rather of the way in which the Soviet system was trying to work with a set of rivers that were tremendously kind of unpredictable in terms of their flood. They were highly seasonal, and that when you take these unpredictable and highly variable types of water systems and try to integrate them into a command economy and kind of administrative framework, and also a kind of colonial type of framework with the kind of native population, that in many respects is what led to at this kind of arbitrariness of rule and a kind of mobilization of the population through violent means. And so, here he's in some ways flipping your question the other way around, in the sense that rather than looking solely at the ways in which humans are destroying nature, thinking about the ways in which the natural world is actually transforming the structures of the Soviet political system and its economy, and the relationship between different ethnic groups is being defined, at least in part, by the physical structures and the hydrological structures of these rivers. Julia Obertreis, which was another one of the articles in that section, makes in some ways sort of similar types of arguments about the ways in which the structures of water, in this case, kind of pollution of water that occurred because of various sorts of irrigation policies, particularly cotton growing policies, in the regions now Uzbekistan, that human response to this led to the development of a political environmental movement that critiqued state power and championed the ideas of the application of other types of models and other types of kind of water use practices to the point that it becomes a fundamental, not so much threat to the system, but a challenge to the structure of the system. And as she comes to the conclusion at the end that it's really important to realize the degree to which, on the one hand, there is an environmental movement that grew up strongly and powerfully in the Soviet Union, and then that this environmental movement is one of the reasons by the time we get to the 1980s and early 1990s that the Soviet system in fact came to an end. So that here again, the water, pollution of water, disease in water, and this sort of thing transformed human activity by creating this, helping to foster this environmental movement, which then ultimately destabilized the Soviet political structure.
So let's talk about the other big resource in Central Asia, which is land, particularly arable and grazing land. This is a problem that, again, transcends, these political systems. It started in the imperial era when you start having Russian settlers being moved out to the steppes and coming into conflict with, the grazing nomadic peoples. And of course, continues during the Soviet period when you have things such as the settlement of nomads and conflict again between settled populations and nomadic populations. What role did the environmental conditions play in this conflict, and how was the environment impacted by change in land use?
Mm-hmm. Again, just a fabulous type of question. The authors in this book really focus on the ways in which the nature, well, I keep saying the nature of, but the environment, the characteristics of the environment in this particular place, when that intersects with human ideas and ways of thinking and human sort of sociopolitical and economic structures, leads to a whole series of outcomes. And so, as you said, I mean, in some ways, the standard textbook story of Russian expansion and Soviet expansion into the steppe region is one of this relatively quick, from a human perspective, transformation of what had been grasslands, which had been primarily used for pastoral nomadism, into kind of areas of settled agriculture. And all of these kind of articles explore the ways in which, in fact, that broad story is true. The process by which it took place, in some respects, is more interesting and more complicated, and helps to really understand the relationship between different groups of people and the place quite differently. So, for example, Ian Campbell in his chapter looks at this phenomenon called jut, which is this remarkable kind of freezing on the steppe. It's a kind of layer of snow and ice that freezes solid over top of the steppe so that animals can't reach, they can't break through it, they can't access any food there. And as a result, you have kind of massive famines on the part for this livestock if they can't move quickly enough to get somewhere else. And what's important about that story is not just that not just the ways in which the this kind of freezing process affected the livestock herders and their herds, but the way in which Jute in particular was a tremendously important became a kind of tremendously important idea for Tsarist administrators in the sense that they saw Jute in some ways they characterized it as a disaster, which is something that the nomads hadn't before. I mean, it was just something that they lived with before. The Tsarist state came in and saw this as this is a kind of natural disaster, and they believed it a natural disaster that was caused by what the Tsarist officials saw as the kind of less civilized, less capable characteristics of the pastoral nomads. And so as they justified them to themselves the idea of transforming these grasslands into agricultural fields to actually till the soil, the fact of Jute, the fact of this freezing, was referred to repeatedly as justification for tilling the soil, for putting an end to pastoral nomadism, and in particular for instituting policies of allowing the migration of Russian peasants to settle into this region. So a big part of what justifies, and in fact, in some ways, what creates the whole ideology of peasant resettlement and settled agriculture and the tilling of the soil, these are things that come out of a human response on the part of the Tsarist officials to this particular environmental reality, this sort of sudden freezing that happens on the steppe in specific kinds of conditions. And so the whole idea of a kind of a mission civilatrice is something that that develops in great part in discussions over Jute. Sarah Cameron, who talks about a similar kind of story a little bit more broadly about the ways in which the Kazakh pastoral nomads were transformed by the process, really highlights the way in which the settlement of these people was by no means a foregone conclusion as Russians arrived, that it required a whole series of stages and processes to make it happen. And that it was neither a straight line, nor, as I said, foregone. But that a big part of the story of what we see here of the kind of transformation of the experiences of the Kazakh nomads has to do with the ways in which they became less and less resilient over time. The steppe is, again, is a kind of variable type of climate, particularly in terms of temperature and water and this sort of thing. And the arrival of Russians, the beginnings of settled agriculture, really reduced the resiliency of the nomadic peoples. And for two reasons: one, because they began to integrate more and more grain into their diet, something they had not before, and this is grain that they would need to kind of purchase or trade for, this sort of thing, and this kind of shift in diet to include a greater percentage of grain. Actually meant that they were ingesting less food and less calories. And so that at moments where the environment became more extreme and more difficult to live in, they were more vulnerable and less resilient to those kinds of changes. So as we're thinking about, well, what are the fate of the nomadic peoples? The variability of the climate is tremendously important, and the way which it then intersected with small changes, particularly the addition of grain to their diet. One of the other articles in this section, I mean, there's two others that are great. One by Mark Ely deals with the ways in which the efforts to kind of settle and to grow grain on the steppe, particularly in the 20th century, led to amazing debates among scientists over questions of climate change. So that, you know, the persistence of drought and issues of trying to grow grain in these areas it brought about really, really interesting and thoughtful discussions of just what was climate change and what caused these kinds of problems. And so a lot of initial Soviet discussion of the whole question of climate modeling and all these sorts of things come out of this particular region and efforts, particularly in the Virgin Lands campaign and this sort of thing, to grow grain in an area that was really hard for it because of this variability of water and temperature and this sort of thing.
I think that's really interesting. And I think that this is unfortunately something that's lacking in a lot of studies in Soviet history. You know, like I said, I do a lot on collectivization, and looking at things such as the impact of climate is really important. Different diseases, different crop failures. Certainly in the Kirov region, most of it really is caused by our sort of schizophrenic climate we can have. Like this year we had snow, 2018, we had snow on the 1st of June. And it killed everybody's potatoes. So, you know, I think that we often tend to over-prioritize the political factors and under-prioritize these things. So I think this is a really interesting step forward.
Can I just jump in on that? I was just going to say that, I mean, I think that one of the things that's really, that I really love about the authors in this book is that they are doing exactly what you said. They're saying, they're reminding us of the importance of the physical world, whether it's other animals or other, you know, plants, or whether it's water or air or land, that, and reminding us that it's not just, as you say, political or economic structures or this sort of thing. But they're also not kind of swinging from one pole to the other. They're not saying, oh, it's only climate. It's, you know, that it's only rainfall that matters or this sort of thing. That, you know, each of these chapters is particularly important because it really, they try to explore the ways in which these two, the kind of human world of political decisions and cultural practices and cultural understandings and social systems and all these things are constantly intersecting with the physical realities of the world in which we are, you know, sort of deeply embedded. And so it's part of a much larger kind of rethinking of how we should understand how causation, you know, how causation works in human history, what causes the kinds of outcomes that we have in any given moment in human history, and really reminding us of how humans are consistently and deeply embedded in a series of kind of ongoing mutually influential relationships between, you know, flora, fauna, climate, water, and all these things, and the kind of the human experience at the same time, to the point that you can't separate them anymore. There's a real push in this book towards what, you know, what the Buddhists would call the non-duality. That is the ways in which, you know, humans and nature exist simultaneously, fully integrated, kind of into each other. And so, often the way we talk about humans and nature is if they are separate entities, fundamentally misses the point of how it is a constant and ongoing set of relationships. So rather than privileging one or the other, they're really looking at the ways in which these relationships are constantly reinforcing and transforming each other in producing the historical outcomes that we did, in fact, have.
So far, we've really only talked about basically negative intersections that produce pretty bad historical outcomes. But there are actually good historical outcomes, too, in Russian history. For example, ecotourism. You know, Imperial Russia pioneered health-related ecotourism in places like Karelia and Crimea. It continues to this day. You know, here in the Kirov region, we have Mineral Springs Sanatorium, which, just for our listeners, is a place where you go and get health treatments, not a mental hospital. And so how did people start figuring out that they needed to keep these places ecologically pure, that they were healthy, and what sort of services did they offer over the course of time from Imperial Russia to the Soviet Union to the modern era?
One of the great examples we can point to is Crimea. I mean, we talk about ecotourism, but also just kind of environmental health tourism. There's a chapter in the book by George Lywood which looks at the kind of origins of this particular process, where he shows the ways in which Crimea became what the Russians used to call a kind of a coast of health. It became a place that was associated with cures for disease, with general health for the population, and that this was something that was, you know, in part part of of the imperial process, that the Crimea had been brought into to the Russian Empire in the 18th century, and perhaps differently than some other areas, it was integrated not so much necessarily through the military or this sort of thing, but rather through the use of this place as health tourist sites. And it was a process over the course of the 19th century, particularly in the late 19th century, where doctors in these areas realized that The specific kind of characteristics of this region, the temperatures, the qualities of the air, the quality of the water, the Black Sea in terms of the specific salt and mineral content, and the types of produce that could be produced in the Crimean region, that these were things that had health benefits for the population, and doctors in the late 19th, early part of the 20th century in Russia, they clearly understood the kind of bacterial revolution. They understood germ theory. They understood that disease was caused by, you know, small microscopic things that we couldn't see. But they also still held very strongly to a kind of environmental approach to health, to cures, and to kind of health maintenance. Where they believed that being exposed to and within specific types of kind of quote unquote healthy environments could really do a lot to cure people who were sick, and also to keep those who were healthy even more healthy, to kind of bolster the immune system and this sort of thing. And so, you know, the Crimean coast over the course of the late 19th, early part of the 20th century, and then on through the 20th century into the Soviet period, became a place where people went for, I mean, not just for relaxation by the water, but for actual health treatments. And these would range from everything from just sort of, you know, sometimes the doctors would prescribe sitting out in the sun or just going to float out in the Black Sea. In other cases, they would prescribe kind of mud baths of different sorts, you know, the most, in some ways, the most famous or infamous was the grape treatment, where you would eat only grapes for many days on end, increasing the number of grapes you ate as you went through. This was a kind of this would just purge your whole system of anything that was wrong with it, and so there was a whole series of kind of health activities that you could do in this particular area. And this is a story of the way in which the human interaction with the nature and the environment of Crimea was one that didn't necessarily lead to, you know, hydroelectric dams or pollution or this sort of thing, but rather led to the development of a health tourist process and the development of an entire network and infrastructure of health preservation and kind of medical facilities in this particular area that took advantage of what they saw as the desirable qualities of the air and the water and the soil and this sort of thing in that particular region, and people came from all over Russia and the Soviet Union and other parts of the world to take the cures that were available there.
So I guess this leads me to my last question: was there a conservation movement in Imperial Russia, the Soviet Union, and if so, did they have any sort of success stories?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, very, very much so. The Soviet system the Russian, the Soviet system is probably best known in terms of conservation for the development of a series of nature preserves known as zapovedniks. The zapovedniks were a kind of alternative model to the national park model that the United States has championed globally, in the sense that the zapovedniks were nature preserves that were designed to kind of set aside specific blocks of territory or specific kind of ecosystems, and to prevent, for the most part, humans from entering into those territories. So they were sort of separated out from regular human activity, with the exception of scientific research. And so they were there, these kind of no-go zones, highly protected zones, were separated out in order to kind of protect the ecosystems and the species that were in there, and then also to allow for scientists to kind of see how the natural world and these ecosystems developed and changed over time, kind of absent human impact and human intervention. And the Zapovednik idea developed in the very late kind of Tsarist period, right in as we're coming into World War I. The first state nature preserve in Russia was established in 1916, in the middle of World War I. But then these ideas are taken and expanded widely during the Soviet system, and there are ups and downs at different points in terms of the degree to which there is how much land is protected and how strictly. But the Zapovyednik system is one of the great kind of Russian and Soviet kind of contributions to ideas of nature preservation. And for all of their ups and downs and for whatever weaknesses that system might have, they had tremendous impacts. If you take the example of the first Zapovyednik, which was developed on the shores of Lake Baikal in 1916, and designed particularly to try to protect the population of the sable in that particular area. The sable, which had been hunted out to localized extinction in a lot of areas throughout Siberia over the preceding centuries, once they set up the Zapovyednik of the nature preserve, they were able to restock the populations of the sable within the nature preserve, and then they used those populations to then repopulate the sable back into its kind of natural habitats in other parts of Siberia as well. So they were really able to use them as kind of incubators of for species kind of re-expansion to territory that these species had disappeared from because of human overhunting and this sort of thing. Now, it is also the case that the Zapovyedniks are not the only sort of story of nature protection and nature movements that are really important. You know, as Julia Obertreis points to I was talking about earlier, in terms of the 1970s and 1980s, we see in Central Asia the development of an ecological protection movement that was very public and tremendously well heard, and that had an impact on the political outcomes of that era. And we see similar sorts of things in other parts of Russia as well. Lake Baikal is probably the most famous of all of the different nature protection movements. Lake Baikal is, as everybody may or may not know, is the oldest and largest lake in the world, largest in terms of its depth, in terms of its volume of water, about 20% of all the surface fresh water on the planet. And in the post-war period in particular, as there were efforts to develop industry and economic activities in and around the lake, there was a very strong kind of Baikal protection movement that developed, that found tremendous support throughout the Soviet Union, where Soviet citizens who really believed that Baikal was something really special and worthy of protection would speak up and write letters to the editor, come to public meetings and this sort of thing. So you have a very strong nature protection movement that developed at this time and integrated in with some of the Soviet nature movements like the All Union kind of Nature Protection Society was a massive organization run through the Soviet state, but one that was involved people all over the Soviet Union in environmental protection kinds of activities. You know, everything from litter cleanup to all sorts of other sorts of things, and the list goes on. In the Baltic states, nature protection was tremendously important, both for protecting nature itself, but also as a challenge to the Soviet control of their territories. So we do see a very strong nature protection movement in a variety of different forms in Tsarist Russia and the Soviet Union. And this again speaks to the ways in which the vision of Russian environmental history as simply being one of kind of ecocide or simply a kind of negative story misses some of the larger points of many of the other things that were going on.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us. I think we've probably taken up enough of your time, but it's been great listening to you. So thank you for being on our podcast.
Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure to be here. And thank you for all the great work you do, putting out all these marvelous podcasts.